For members only, Golf Smarter number 324, published on March 13, 2012.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
A longer course doesn't necessarily mean a harder course with Trip Davis.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to Golf Smarter for members only, Trip.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
And I, you know, in between these two recordings, you mentioned that you're leaving for China in matter of moments, so you don't have a ton of time, and I really appreciate you saying yes to me doing this, so let's just get right to it. And when you're talking about golf course design and what kind of impact it has on the average golfer. Now, before I leave this last topic, when you were designing the Tribute down in the Colony, Texas, and you were recreating your favorite Scotland holes, I got to imagine that I've never played in Scotland, but I would think that a lot of the golf courses there are pretty much dictated by the, not just the terrain, but the weather.
Absolutely. I mean, the wind is one of the more prevalent factors. And, you know, and obviously over there, it's not 107 degrees in July. so, you know, the big difference between Scotland and Dallas can be the extreme heat, but from a playing standpoint, the more critical element is wind. And you know, there's a lesser element into the fact that when, you know, it's hot out in the U.S., the ball can sometimes travel further and so forth. But it's not that big of a factor compared to the wind. So you know, the biggest things that we tried to recreate there, from the playing conditions perspective, is making sure that the golf course plays firm and fast, because it's, you know, that's such a big part of the way that the strategy of those courses work in Scotland, is how the ball can bounce, how you can use the ground to run shots from the greens. And you know, some of my favorite holes from over there are the ones where you don't fly the ball to the hole. You've got to land it short. You've got to creatively use the slopes that were built in to get to certain pin locations. And so that was a central part of the design at the Tribute.
So you're telling me when I it doesn't play like a parkland course that's prevalent throughout the United States. So when I get a chance to go out and play the Tribute, I should be thinking of laying up a lot instead of trying to hit the greens? Is this what you're telling me?
Well, you don't necessarily have to lay up, but when you're hitting a shot into the green, you don't necessarily have to fly it to the green.
Okay.
The benefit is in using the slopes. You know, the sixth hole at the Tribute, for instance, is my recreation or my interpretation tribute to one of the holes at Macrahanish on the up in the northwest part of Scotland. And the slopes around the green allow you to bump a ball in and use the slopes to feed it back into the green. And whereas if you try to fly it to the green, and you run the risk of it running through the green, and it's a little more difficult to get to some of the pin locations by flying it, because if you, even if the greens are a little softer at any given time, you've got to fly that ball a certain distance. If you run it into the green, your margin for error is a little less, because the slopes will help contain the ball. And so that's what I mean by kind of bumping and running shots in, or using the ground instead of flying it to the hole.
So that's the kind of stuff that absolutely fascinates me about golf course architecture and design, is using the elements that you have as strategic approaches for a golf shot, like elevated greens. And what you're saying is, right?
Right.
You don't necessarily want to try to land it on the green. You want to get it up to it. But if you come too slow, you come up too low, it's going to fall back.
Well, that's the fun thing about golf course design, is there are really limitless ways in which you can use the ground, you can use the elements, you can use the conditions the golf course is going to be maintained in. You know, to try to design, for instance, the same golf course on bent grass versus Bermuda and so forth. If you're trying to create the same playability, there's got to be changes in the way that the golf course is built so that those features work the same way. You know, bent grass is a totally different playing surface, both in the way you play a shot off of it as compared to Bermuda grass. And, you know, that's changed a little bit over the years, in large measure because we're mowing fairly so much tighter than we used to. But there are just limitless ways in which you can conceive how a player is going to play the hole and how multiple players can play the hole. I'm a big proponent of giving as many players as many options to play the hole, not only just because it will fit their playing style, but because it allows every player of equal scoring ability the ability to compete with each other. One of the things that I've dismayed about with the game today is how long we're making golf courses, not only on tour, but for the average player. It really has become a game more about power in certain respects. And when the game is about scoring, it's not about how you hit the ball, it's about how quickly you get the ball in the hole. And so design needs to give players of differing abilities and different approaches to the game options on how they can play the game, play each hole, and score the thing.
Actually, you beat me to it. I was going to ask the question about how does equipment, today's equipment, and how radically it's changed over the last 5 to 8 years, how does that dictate course design?
Well, it's there can be a good argument made for how it has dictated course design and versus whether or not course design could create some sort of balance between the equipment today that we can play with and the players that play today. I mean, the guys that are playing today, you know, Tiger Woods and Dustin Johnson, these guys are athletes. They're not to say that Nicklaus and Tom Watson and, you know, the greats of the past weren't athletic, but these guys can swing the club, you know, so much faster, and they can hit the ball so much higher and so forth. And golf course design, the response to it was, let's challenge those players with greater physical ability, whether it's the physical nature of, that they bring to the game themselves or what the equipment helps them do physically. And so we've looked at challenging players physically more so than strategically and mentally in a lot of ways. And in a lot of ways, Fred, that makes sense because if you want to challenge the longer player, making the golf course longer is not necessarily challenging them, it's playing into their hands. What you find challenges the longer player better is not always being able to use their length and then also having to compete against a broader range of players. If you take a 144-player field on the PGA Tour and you've got 15 power players and the golf course is 7,700 yards long, you don't have many of those players in that 144-player field that can really compete physically. And so, but whereas when you get a golf course that's, you know, around 7,000 yards, you know, also depending on how firm and fast it plays, how many shots the player is required to play, you bring a lot of players back into the game. I think the setup that Turnberry had the year that Watson almost won is a perfect example of how the golf course was there to challenge a player's ability to score and not what they could do physically.
Yeah, I've played courses that are not necessarily long, but it's very obvious that if you don't have a good short game, it's going to eat you alive.
Right.
I mean, it's going to put you in a position where this is, you know, you get onto the green and you go, oh my gosh, this is definitely a 3-putt green and possibly 4.
Exactly, and even at that, the ultimate golf course is going to be one that doesn't overly penalize someone with a, you know, an average short game. It's one where the player is kind of called on to be able to execute a broad range of shots so that no one strength they had will dominate the golf course But no one weakness that they have can't be overcome in some way if they know how to use their strengths in a way to overcome certain weaknesses. And that's what we're looking at when we're looking at when we're designing golf courses. Is we don't try to focus on making the golf course about any one strength. We're trying to balance the golf course out so that the guy that can hit it a long way has got the advantage on certain holes, but on other holes, he's got to be more accurate. He's got to be a little more precise. He may have to use a short game. He may have to do other things within the game to be able to excel in the golf course as a whole. And that's really where golf design needs to fall in terms of being able to make the game enjoyable for all player levels, and then also when it comes to championship golf, being able to identify the player who can shoot the best four.
How much pressure is there from developers, the people with the money who are coming to hire you saying, I need a golf course, I want a golf course here, I want it to be on the tour? You know, is there a lot of that saying, this course, is you've got to design this, we've got to get this one on the tour because it's going to help me get my money back type of thing?
Well, there's two kind of pressures that, you know, you run into that. I mean, the course we're doing in China right now is one that they hope to be able to host championships. And when we did Old American, there was some pressure there that we want to eventually host something like the U.S. Public Amateur or the U.S. Amateur. Old American was actually recently, they listed four courses that should host tour events around the country.
Awesome.
And it was one of those that was included in that list. And,
congratulations.
And, yeah, that was pretty kind of cool.
Yeah.
But the other pressure is to make it something, a standard. You know, in China, for instance, if the golf course isn't par 72, if it's par 71 or par 70, the culture over there sees it as a lesser golf course. And, you know, in the United States, it's been, you know, the golf course has got to be 7,000 yards long to be seen as a championship golf course. And the perception is that if it can host a tour event or if we can host a tour event, you know, if it's long enough, if it's of a standard quality, that it will help to attract players and help the golf course be sustainable. So you have to balance that to some extent. You know, China, for instance, there's a bit of kind of a funny story about that, in that the land we had to work with, the way that everything worked out, my original design was a par 71. And that's just the way the holes fit on the land the best. And the owner was adamant that we had a par 72. And so what we ended up doing was making that hole an optional par 4, par 3, kind of like George Thomas had done a number of golf courses that he did back in the 20s, the guy that designed Riviera and L.A. Country Club in Bel Air. And so we were able to keep it a par 3 from the back tee, but for the number, it's a short par 4. And so... that's how we, you know, sometimes balance that pressure.
Hmm. How often do you have to design a course, or not even how often, what kind of demands are there? Is that you design a course or you design a hole for playability versus maintenance?
Well, it's, you know, playability is not necessarily... always pitted against maintenance. You know, challenge sometimes can be pitted against maintenance. You know, and it depends on how you define playability. But we always have to be aware that our client is got X amount of dollars to be able to sustain the golf course from a maintenance perspective. You know, some of our clients, you know, they'll have an unlimited maintenance budget. Some of them are in markets where they're not exactly sure where that may fall. And we have to be cognizant of that so that when we design the golf course, the maintainability can be flexible in some ways. If we've got a project where it's in a new market, and, you know, 10 years from now, their maintenance budget may be cut by 20%. We've got to be aware that we don't want the golf course at that time to then have to be redesigned or not maintained to a decent standard because they can't maintain it all. But the big thing that we have the ability to work with, if you're creative enough, is to design a golf course that the setup can dictate how playable it is, how challenging it is, versus how maintainable it is. It's completely possible to build a golf course that is highly maintainable, but if you grow the rough a little bit, you get the fairways a little firmer, you get the greens a little faster. If you've imparted enough subtlety into the golf course to make those really increase the challenge level, then you can build a golf course that's adaptable. And it can go the other way, too. For instance, if to make it a little more playable for the average player, if you cut the rough, you widen the fairways a little bit, or slow the greens down, soften them up a little bit, it becomes more playable.
What are your favorite, well, we'll call them features, your favorite design features? I mean, as a golfer, I call them distractions. But, you know, whether they be fairway bunkers, greenside bunkers, water, elevated greens. What are the features that that is your signature?
Oh, Fred, I don't know if we have a signature in that way. You know, it all depends on the land in a lot of respects. And we do start every project by trying to work towards some sort of concept, whether you call it a theme. And, you know, and when I say theme, it doesn't necessarily mean a visual theme or there's a story behind it, as much as we are looking at the way the features will be built. You know, we're doing a project. We've got a number of projects right now where we've got, you know, five different bunker styles. I mean, from doing a restoration at Brooks Hollow in Dallas, where we're doing a peeling hatch style bunker that's got a little more, it's got more capes and bays in it. To Perry Maxwell restoration up in northeast Oklahoma, where he had originally done grass-based bunkers with very little shape to them and sand in the bottom, to Old American, which is more links-like in terms of, when I say links, I mean more like Irish links-like, where your bunkers are a little ragged-edged and so forth. So you want to be able to adapt to the site, and the ability to have more of a broad creative range on how you use those features is important. Now, how you use those features gets into what I think your question was mostly about, and as to how do I use the features in such a way that it enhances the play of the game. And, you know, for instance, an elevated green with no backdrop to it creates a depth perception problem. And that's one of the things that we always try to play on, is subtle things that make the golf course a little more difficult or confounds the player without making it really more physically difficult. And the more you can challenge a player's ability to feel a shot, the better you can make the golf course interesting to play, but yet not a lot more physically difficult. And, you know, elevated greens with no backdrop is one thing. You know, how you position bunkers in a fairway to create depth perception. For instance, if you put a bunker on the short side of a hole and it's a big, long bunker, and you put one just, you know, 10 or 15 yards longer on the left side and you make it a smaller bunker, you've created a depth perception issue where that bunker on the left looks like it's miles further out there, and it makes it a little harder to feel the shot. So those are kind of the mad scientist-type things that we work on.
That you probably laugh behind your back. What do you mean feel? You mean for the golfer when they're standing there addressing, looking at their shot, deciding what they have to do? Is that what you mean by feel a shot?
Right. And, you know, just think of it this way. I mean, when you hit an 8-iron, if you stand on a range and you're trying to hit your 8-iron 140 yards, if you're on the range and you've got a perfectly level lie, there's no wind, you can, with a lot of practice and skill, can retrieve that shot to where you can hit it 135 to 145 yards. But you get out on the golf course and you end up with an uphill lie or a downhill lie, a sidehill lie, the green's 30 feet below you, or 30 feet above you, the wind at your back, or it's in your face. You can't just judge strictly on distance. You have to kind of feel that shot.
Yeah, you know how long it took me to figure that out?
Yeah. And so the cues that we can throw out there as golf course architects can either sometimes encourage your ability to feel a shot, or we can make it more of a challenge to be able to feel a shot. And it doesn't go to just distances as well. It can go to whether or not you want to favor the right side. You know, if a player can move the ball right to left, it may, you know, we may build a hole that looks like a right to left shot. It's going to feel more, it's going to feel more comfortable to them. Whereas we can create a hole that looks more like a left to right shot. And, you know, for a player that plays the ball right to left, that hole feels less comfortable.
You mentioned earlier about if a course is a par 70 or 71, you said in China that they think it's a lesser of a golf course. I can see that. I can see it's like, oh, it's only par 71. But it just means there's one less par 5. There's only one less par 3, basically.
It depends. You know, we've done a lot of par 71s recently, and in a large measure it's because of the way the land works and so forth. And I'm also a big fan of having more than four par 3s on a golf course. So, you know, a fifth par 3 can add a lot of variety to a golf course.
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned in the last episode about the rhythm of a golf course and the way that the golf course flows. And, you know, I'm a big proponent in making every hole feel a little different. And it's harder to make two par 4s feel different than it is if you have a par 3 following a par 4.
Yeah.
Just simply because of the length of the hole and the way that you're going to play the shot. And so we often will do that. We'll make a par 71, not necessarily by one less par 5, but one more par 3. So, you know, it really comes down to the quality of the golf course. I mean, one of my favorite golf courses in the world is one of Morsford in Providence, Rhode Island. It's an old Donald Ross course that they play the Northeast Amateur on, and it's a par 69.
Wow.
But it's a great golf course.
Wow. I played course Seviano Links up in Corning, California. I just posted a video on YouTube about it. It's a John Daly design, so it's very long, but there's three par threes and three par fives on each side.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that to be really entertaining.
Yeah, you know, as long as those holes fit the land and they create more interest in the way that the course is played, then that's great. I don't think there should be any standards as to having, you know, third par 36 on both sides, and or, you know, that you have to have four par 5s and four par 3s, and they don't need to be in any sort of order. You know, Capoeira, where they play the first term of the year, par 73, and that's because when Bill Coore and Ben Crenshaw were building it, they had an extra par 5 that fit into the landscape better. So.
Yeah, I found it far more entertaining to have that kind of variety. You know, it's like when you come par 4, par 4, par 4, it's like just hit it far and then, you know, set yourself up. And I don't necessarily like pulling out the driver every time. I like teeing off with a 3-wood occasionally and setting myself up for, you know, a shot that I'm going to strategically be more comfortable with, hitting it 125 yards, you know, versus 160 yards or I like that kind of variety.
Yeah, it's you know, the variety is the most important part about keeping the golf course interesting.
Yeah.
And so it's vital.
And what brings the average golfer back again and again? Is it interesting or is it scoring? Is like, okay, I can beat this course, I'm coming back, or this is such a challenge, like golf is in itself, this is such a challenge, I got to come back and try to, you know, beat this beast.
I think, you know, for the average player, it can be a lot of different things. You know, it can be scoring, it can be the visual nature of the golf course, it can be the interesting shots that they have to play, and so, you know, it can be a wide variety of things. I mean, it's one of the great things about the game is that every player is going to bring their own perspective to the golf course and what gets their juices flowing. This, you know, typically for the average player, when we're designing a golf course, and you know, to make sure that the average player can have fun, and you know, 20 years of doing this, the feedback that I get is less about scoring and it's less about visual as much as it is about constant variety within the golf course, that they're never having to play the same shot, that they're always having to do something different. That's you know, the most important thing. And at the same time, you don't want to beat the average player up. I mean, you don't want that, you don't want a 10 handicap going out there and not being able to break 90.
Yeah, well, they walk away from the course going, I hate this place.
Yeah, they can. Yeah. But it's, you know, interest is more important than anything. And that was reinforced last weekend. We opened a course called Turtle Dunes in Acapulco. And I was very interested to see what the players had to say afterwards. We had about 100 players play that day. And so I stuck around and talked to a lot of them. And while a lot of them would say, you know, I shot lower than my handicap, you know, I really enjoyed things, the main thing that was always given back was that every hole had a different feel, and I was always interested in what I was doing.
That's fabulous.
That's important.
Yeah, because so often when you see websites, you read reviews of golf courses, they talk about the beauty around it. And it's like, really? Is it, that's the best you've got, is that it's so such a beautiful place? Which, listen, I love playing on places that are visually spectacular around the course or the wildlife that's flying or running by. But still, I think you're right. The variety of shots that you have to take makes, you know, the more clubs you can use in your bag, the more entertaining your day is going to be.
Playing on a site right by the ocean, or you know, there's obvious interest in that. Mm-hmm. You know, one of my favorite golf courses in the world too is Garden City up on Long Island, and you know, it's in the middle of town. There's, you know, there's nothing around it to really see. One of the last golf courses you'd call beautiful from an aesthetic perspective, but it's beautiful from the standpoint that you're constantly being confronted with having to play different shots. And those are the golf courses that tend to stand the test of time better.
Hmm. Do you have time for one more question, or do I have to invite you to come back again?
I got time for one more.
Does that mean you're not going to come back?
Well, I'll come back too, but I got time for one more.
Okay. The difference, and hopefully this is an easy answer, what's the difference between restoration, renovation, and reconstruction on a golf course when you get involved in a project?
Well, renovation is really trying to put the golf course back into the state it was before it deteriorated in some way. Renovation, you know, can most times mean just maintenance-related things. The features of a golf course really have lifespans. They don't, you know, last forever. You know, a bunker is not going to function the way you want it to forever. Tees don't stay level forever. Greens don't grow grass and aren't as maintainable as you want them to be forever as well. So renovation oftentimes just means, you know, restoring or putting those things back into a way that they can function properly. Restoration is more about putting it back into a state that it was in that was some form of higher design, some form of higher functionality, some form of higher historic quality. So we're not only making the feature itself more functional, we're also introducing the way that it was intended to be played, in some cases the way it was intended to look. And too often times what we get caught up in with restoration is putting it back the way that it was instead of understanding why the way it was. For instance, if you can put a green back to the way it was in the 1920s, that possibly not, might not be playable at today's green speeds. But if you understand why the green was designed the way it was, why there was a back shelf on a par 5 that required you to land the shot short and bump it up to that back pin location, you can restore it in such a way that modern player can experience the golf course the way it was intended to be. And that's really what restoration should be about. Reconstruction is can take on a lot of different forms, right? I mean, it can be everything from completely rebuilding a golf course in a different routing. It can be taking a feature on a golf course that historically or today doesn't function properly or didn't function properly and reconstructing it in such a way that it has more interest and plays better. You know, in the modern times, a lot of times reconstruction will go to rebranding the golf course in such a way that they can open themselves up to a broader market appeal.
Absolutely fascinating. Tripp, I really appreciate you giving me this much time, and I wish you great success, continued success, and that you become a legend so we can talk about you for years to come and your courses. And please, safe travels and good luck in the Far East.
Well, thanks. Anytime.
I don't know if you had a chance to see the February 26th weekend edition of the Wall Street Journal, but there was this interesting article on golf's biggest delusions. So, coming up next, we get two episodes with the Journal's golf columnist, John Paul Newport. John Paul and I also talk about covering all four majors each year and his relationships with players like Tiger, Phil, Rory, and more. Really interesting guy, and that's why I was excited to get two episodes out of him. Thank you once again for joining Golf Smarter for members only. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for me, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.